Season 5, episode 61 of this podcast, and this time we'll be discussing another interesting topic about generative AI. For today's podcast episode, we have invited a former Google, McKinsey, and Atlassian pioneer technology leader, Mr. Dan Kubertoff, and presently the founder and CEO of Reinvention Labs, from Chicago, USA, as he shares with us his valuable insights on generative AI and its critical importance to our digital economy. So let's get started. Thank you for listening to FinCircle and welcome to our podcast. Generative artificial intelligence describes algorithms such as ChatGPT that can be used to create new content, including audio, code, images, text, simulations, and videos. Recent breakthroughs in the field have the potential to drastically change the way we approach content creation. In the years since its wide deployment, machine learning has demonstrated impact in a number of industries, accomplishing things like medical imaging analysis, for instance, as well as high-resolution weather forecasts. In 2022, McKinsey's survey shows that AI adoption has more than doubled over the past 5 years. And investment in AI is exponentially increasing. It's clear that generative AI tools like ChatGPT, wherein GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, and image generator called DALL-E, have the potential to change how a range of jobs are performed. And the full scope of that impact, though, is still unknown, as well as the risk. But still, organizations of all stripes have raced to incorporate Gen AI tools into their business models, looking to capture a piece of a sizable prize. In fact, McKinsey research indicates that Gen AI applications stand to add more or less around $4.4 trillion to the global economy annually. And it seems possible that within the next 3 years, anything in the technology, media, and telecommunication space that connected to AI will be considered obsolete or ineffective. Building a generative AI model has, for the most part, been a major undertaking, to the extent that only a few well-resourced tech heavyweights have made an attempt. One of them is OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. Former GPT models and DALL-E has billions in funding from boldface name donors. DeepMind, on the other hand, is a subsidiary of Alphabet, the parent company of Google, and even Meta, which owns by Facebook, has dipped a toe into the generative AI model pool with its Make a Video product. And these companies employ some of the world's best computer scientists and engineers. But it's not just talent. When you're asking a model to train using nearly the entire internet, it's going to cost you as well. OpenAI, for instance, hasn't released exact cost, but estimates indicate that GPT-3 was trained on around 45 terabytes of text data. That's about 1 million feet of bookshelf space, or even a quarter of the entire Library of Congress, at an estimated cost of several million dollars. And these aren't resources your garden variety startup can access. The opportunity for businesses is clear. Generative AI tools can produce a wide variety of credible writing in seconds, then respond to criticism to make the writing more fit for purpose. And this has the implications for a wide variety of industries, from IT and software organizations that can benefit from the largely correct code generated by AI models, to organizations in need of marketing copy, for instance. In short, any organization that needs to produce clear written materials potentially stands to benefit. And organizations can also use generative AI to create more technical materials, such as higher resolution versions of medical images. And with the time and resources saved here, organizations can pursue new business opportunities and the chance to create more value. And we've seen that developing generative AI model is so resource intensive that it is out of the question for all but the biggest and best resource companies. And companies looking to put generative AI to work have the option to either use generative AI out of the box or fine-tune them to perform a specific task. And because they are so new, we have to yet see the long tail effects of generative AI models. This means that there are some inherent risks involved in using them. Some are known and some are unknown. And the outputs generative AI models produce may often sound extremely convincing. This is by design. But sometimes the information they generate is just plain wrong. And worst, sometimes it biases. For example, ChatGPT won't give you instruction on how to hotwire a car, for instance. But if you say you need to hotwire a car to save a baby, the algorithm is happy to comply. Organizations that rely on generative AI models should reckon with reputational and legal risks involved in unintentionally publishing biased, offensive, or copyright content. And this risk can be mitigated, however, in a few ways. For one, it's crucial to carefully select the initial data used to train these models to avoid including toxic or biased content. It can't be emphasized enough that this is a new field. The landscape of risk and opportunities is likely to change rapidly in coming weeks, months, and years. And new use cases are being tested monthly, and new models are likely to be developed in the coming years. As generative AI becomes increasingly and seamlessly incorporated into business, society, and our personal lives, we can also expect a new regulatory climate to take shape. As organizations begin experimenting and creating value with these tools, leaders will definitely do well to keep a finger on the pulse of regulation and risk. So there you are. There are so many value propositions of this generative AI, but there's still a couple of risks that we have to take into consideration and mitigate in the long term. In today's podcast episode, we'll be talking to a pioneering technology leader, Mr. Dan Shuferkov, formerly from the tech giant Google, as well as the prestigious global enterprise McKinsey. And he's also been once upon a time part of this $6 billion IPO Atlassian. And he's presently the chief executive officer of Reinvention Labs, based in Chicago, USA. As he walks us through the value proposition of generative AI and its significant relevance to our digital economy. It's an honor and privilege to have you, Dan, and welcome to FinCircle.
Thank you so much, Edgar. I'm excited to be here. I can't wait for the conversation today. We're going to talk about some fun stuff. I'm really passionate about some of these topics and can't wait to dig into the meat of some of them. So thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Dan, for joining us today, and we do appreciate that. Let's probably start by describing on what is a generative AI, as well as its present state, and where do you think we are heading?
Yeah, so I think first I'll say I like talking about generative AI specifically because I think sometimes people are overusing the term AI right now to include some of the machine learning things that we've been doing for 20 years and also large language model generative AI. And those are very different things. And so what generative AI really is an algorithm that has a deep understanding of language, words in a series. And what that makes it possible is the ability to answer questions, the ability to listen to a conversation like this one and automatically transcribe and understand what was discussed. And that's a really, really powerful thing that we haven't had before. And so we'll talk about some of the use cases that's enabling now. But fundamentally, it's the ability for AI to understand words. And we'll talk about images a little bit too, but it does the same thing with images. Just like a paragraph is a series of words, a picture is a series of pixels. And when you know the first three pixels, you might be able to predict the next one. Just like you know, if you know the first three words in a sentence, you can probably predict the fourth one. So it's the same thing going on. That's how it's working. And we'll talk about some of those things as we finish the hour here.
I understand, Dan, that you've worked with prominent technology organizations like Google, McKinsey, and Atlassian. Hence, what are your main influences and motivation in joining this remarkable technology enterprise?
I think one of the things is I've had the fortunate serendipity to be exactly the age that I am. And what that meant was when I started my career in 1993, we weren't yet using PCs on my team. We had a mainframe computer, dumb terminals with little short menus that would let us pick the things we could do. And then a year into that, we got a shipment of PCs for our team. And so all of a sudden, we went from having none of those things to having all the potential that Windows and client-server applications gave us. And I didn't have a legacy that I was built on. Like, I didn't know any of those other things. So I could learn the mainframe or I could learn the PC, and it was all the same to me. So I dove on the PC and tried to learn as much as I could about it. And then 5 years after that, we got the internet. And so I tackled it in the same way. And then 5 years after that, we got the mobile. BlackBerry put phones in our pocket, and now we could email on the go, which was crazy. And so I figured out mobile, and then I figured out cloud, and then I figured out data science, and then I figured out remote teamwork. And now AI is just the next one of those things. It's the seventh major transformation that we've had in 30 years. And so I've been really excited about those new changes and how they impact our teams and the way we do work. And that's been my passion for the whole entire breadth of my career. AI is just the next one of those things that we'll tackle, but it's also the biggest and most impactful one. So it'll change a lot more things a lot more quickly.
Given your considerable exposure to generative AI, Dan, then what are the initial hurdles that you've somehow encountered and your relevant takeaways from these challenging circumstances?
Yeah, I think so. First, I'll say the humongous opportunity is with respect to the way we share information on our teams. Right. We spend a lot of time on our teams talking to each other. We have meetings, we send emails, we open up Slack or Teams and we chat with each other. And all of that information sharing consumes a lot of our time on teams. Some teams are spending 2/3 of their time. Other teams are spending 80% of their time just sharing information. However, AI is going to streamline that dramatically. Like, we might not need to have meetings at all. We're certainly not going to look at email messages one message at a time. However, once we start applying AI to streamlining some of that messaging, we're going to need ways of paying attention to what's happening, jumping in and interjecting when AI makes a mistake, because AI is pretty good at making mistakes, right? It does the best that it can in predicting what might be next, but it doesn't know every time. It's like if you're sending a text message to a friend, autocomplete is telling you the next word that you might text. It's wrong a lot of the time, but it's right a lot of the time too. And autocomplete is just the first generative AI that we ever got to play with. And so as we start using AI to solve a lot more processes on our team, create a lot more efficiencies, we're going to need a way of jumping in rapidly when it's making a mistake so we can, you know, point the car back in the right direction.
One of the interesting questions that was shared to us, Dan, was that how does generative AI works and its current limitations?
Yeah, so first, fundamentally, you may have heard the acronym GPT, right? ChatGPT is called a GPT because it's a generative pre-trained transformer. Now, the generative means it makes something new that wasn't there before. Pre-trained means it looks at a bunch of information in advance and then tries to decide what's next. And then transform means, you know, you put a prompt in and it gives you something back. It transforms your prompt into something new. Now, the reason I dove into that acronym so much is that P in the middle means it's pre-trained. That means the stuff that it knows has to already be on the internet somewhere. It can't know new things. It can't know what we wish the world was like. It only knows the way the world was. And there are lots of biases in the world. There are lots of things that have been a certain way for a long time. And we aspire to make those things different. Like, we wish the world was more sustainably run, right? We wish we weren't creating so much global warming. We wish the people in the world weren't filled with so much bias and hate, but they have been. And so our AI algorithms will inherit those things as well. So if you want the world to be less biased, or if you want the world to be more sustainable, or you want the world to be happier, or whatever you aspire, it's going to be hard to get those things out of AI because it's trained on the last 30 years of content. And the last 30 years didn't look like we want the next 10 years to look. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, Dan. Anyway, what are some popular generative AI models that you are somehow aware of? And the adoption ratio that you have observed at this point in time?
Yeah, so that's an important thing to pay attention to, I think, as well. So about 2017, 2018, some of the big language model providers started to ingest a bunch of language models and start trying to figure out if they could make them smarter by using more and more training data. And early Google started with one of the training models, and they used about 50 million pieces of content. That was back in 2017, right? And soon after that, OpenAI was created, and it created a training model with about 150 million pieces of content. And those were okay. It was better than autocorrect on our cell phones, right? Autocorrect was trained with massively less data. But it still wasn't magical. And then over time, as we got to 2019 and 2020 and 2021, both Google and OpenAI started using more training data to train their models. And things really changed in 2022 when ChatGPT came out, right? Right before we had ChatGPT, we had OpenAI's GPT 3.0. And that was trained with a lot of data, billions of examples of content. And even the scientists that were working on that were surprised at the accuracy of the responses that came out. You could ask it a question and it seemed to understand what you meant by that. Even weird, nuanced questions that involve a lot of idiosyncrasies of language. And so it took billions of rows of content to really make that transition. And then two, it took a chat interface. Because prior to ChatGPT coming out, generative algorithms existed and large language models existed. But to get to them, you had to be a software engineer. You needed to know what APIs were. And that made it hard and inaccessible. And the chat interface on top of GPT-3 about 18 months ago, almost exactly, really, really changed the world's understanding of what you could do and its current state. And that was massive. One more thing I'll say about amount of training data. A lot of people want now to create their own private training data, right? I want to, as a content creator, I want to take the book that I wrote and all the emails that I wrote and this conversation, and I want to upload it and I want to train my algorithm so that it knows how I think and what I might say. But I write a lot of stuff, but I might only have a few hundred thousand examples of content. That might be a stretch. I've never actually tried to count. And when Google had a language model that only had 50 million examples, it wasn't very good. And so when people try to train their own model on a specific thing, I think they're going to find they don't actually have enough examples of content to really make it truly powerful.
That's a very good point, Dan. Can you kindly explain the difference between generative AI and discriminative AI?
Yeah. So the example that I use to try to describe this is if you go to the airport, and before you can get to where the gates are, you have to go through airport security. And when you do that, you put your suitcase or your backpack or whatever you have with you on the belt, and it goes under the scanner. And the scanner looks at your suitcase and decides if there's a knife inside or not. It goes through the scanner and it passes or fails a test. And that's discriminative AI, right? These are recognition algorithms. It can't create something new. It can only recognize whether a problem exists or does not exist. The other thing that's important about that analogy is the scanner doesn't work by itself. There's a person sitting at that scanner looking at what's going on. And as a new suitcase goes under the belt with something new in it that scanner never saw before, it flags it for the person's attention. And that person has to jump in and say, no, that's probably fine. I can see very clearly that that's just a camera, or whatever else it might be, right? And sometimes from the scanner, they're still not sure. And so they flag it and a person opens the suitcase on the other side. That's how machine learning works. The scanner does the best job it can, but then the person managing the scanner helps it when it gets stuck. And then once it helps it, it knows for next time when it sees that same thing again. That's how discriminative AI works. And that's really what machine learning is. And so first and foremost, I don't call discriminative AI AI. I call it machine learning because it's not artificially intelligent. It's just been programmed to recognize scenarios and flag them. And so that's how I start to distinguish that. Recognition algorithms have been around for 25, 35 years. They're just getting smarter and smarter and smarter as we can use cameras to look at the world and try to decide, make an understanding of what's going on in that picture.
That's quite spot on, Dan. Moving on to another interesting topic. What are the privacy concerns related to generative AI?
Yeah, so the first thing, depending on which language model you're using, your data is going somewhere. And so first and foremost, in the world of AI, we should get better at reading privacy policies, right? As people, we should know where our data is going. And if we don't know where that data is going, or we know and we don't like it, we should not put things in there that we don't want, you know, uploaded to the internet. And so first and foremost, that's the first thing. Now, the world's already been managing that in the past. Like, I have a blog and I put things on the blog that I want the world to see, and I don't put things on the blog that I don't want the world to see. And people make that decision all the time. We put things on the website for our company that we want to make public for the world, and we keep things like our sales reports, we keep those things private. And people will have to make that same decision as well, right? The second thing is, you will be able to take open sourced models, like the one from Meta, right? It's called Lambda. You could take that model and run it on your own servers, and then things are more private than they would have been. And so, you know, organizations that are really concerned about the stuff that they put into their models, I think should look into privatizing that model with one of the open source choices. The downside of doing that is these models are improving rapidly. The ChatGPT algorithm right now updates about every 4 or 5 months, and that'll probably speed up. And so if you're an organization that wants to take an open source model and install it on your own servers and create some software that interacts with it, know that all the work that you do once you grab that model and put it on site is going to be obsolete in a couple months. And so be really diligent about how you connect effort that you put into privatizing models with those models, because they are going to evolve rapidly. We will get to the point where our language models are updating every single day or maybe every hour. Just like search, right? When you search something on Google, you want to see things that happened yesterday. And when we ask a question to our AI assistant, we're going to want it to know what happened yesterday too.
From your perspective, Dan, what are the future prospects of generative AI?
I think it will touch everything in some way. It will impact all of our lives as knowledge workers for sure, and as other kinds of workers as well. The first thing it's going to do is make language more efficient, right? All of us will start using AI assistants. We'll ask it questions. It will give us feedback. It'll be like our personal coach. So as we start interacting with our assistant and it starts remembering the things that we asked it then it will start understanding us and giving us advice, right? And representing us in meetings that we don't even go to. Like from an information management perspective, I think that's the thing that will be the most transformative. Again, because like I said at the beginning of this conversation, some of us are spending 66% or 80% of our time just exchanging information with our teammates, and AI can dramatically change that. The next thing that will happen though is AI is not just good at language, it's also good at programming, because programming is just a language that computers speak. And so it will also be capable of creating software programs, and that software program generation will start powering automation of technology that's not knowledge work. Like it will program robot tasks, right? It will start programming machines that operate factories and tractors that harvest food, right? Those kinds of things take sophisticated programming and engineering now, and AI will start speeding up those kinds of things as well. And so both in the knowledge workforce, as well as in the mechanical and human productivity workforce, we're going to see impact from AI. It's going to impact everything. But I think all jobs will continue to exist. I don't think any jobs will be completely displaced by AI. I think that the way we work will just change a little bit over time.
Fully agree on that, Dan. Given your significant experience on this field, any word of advice that you can give to everyone on the generative AI initiatives is concerned?
Yeah, I think the first thing is start looking at your week and figuring out what kind of work do you do. Do you process tasks? You get information, run it through a series of steps, and pass it along the value chain? Or do you look for problems and alert people that those problems exist? Or do you find that problems exist and solve them? Or do you create new things that never existed? All of us are probably doing some combination of all four of those things. As AI starts automating the basic task stuff and the problem recognition, then our job becomes chief problem solver. In whatever scenario we're in, whether we are, you know, an artist, or whether we're a project manager, or whether we're a software developer or an airline pilot, our job is not to fly the plane. Our job is to take over from autopilot when autopilot has a problem, right? And that's how all jobs will work. And so my advice is, first, figure out what kind of work you're doing. What percentage of your week is problem solving? Because that's a thing that, as the robots do, and as the robots and AI do some of the process-driven work, it will free up our time for solving harder problems faster. And that's what I think all jobs become as AI starts taking over.
Very well said. Are there any initiatives that you're working on, Dan, that you would like to share with our podcast listening audience? And most importantly, what are the easiest way of reaching you?
Yeah, so I'll tackle those questions in the opposite order. First, the easiest way to reach me is searching my last name. So my last name is Chu Parkoff, Chuparkoff. And I'm pretty easy to find on the internet. There are only like 25 of us, and I'm best at search optimization in the family. So you'll find me, if you connect with me on LinkedIn, I engage there a lot. I love connections. I learn as much from the people around me as hopefully they learn from me. So connect with me on LinkedIn and let's continue this conversation from where we started today. I don't work at a software company. I don't have a product that I'm trying to sell. I am just an AI educator and an innovation keynote speaker. So if you want to learn more about AI and innovation and how to transform the way your team does work, reach out to me and we can talk about like how I can help. If you're having an event and you want a speaker to come in and share how AI is changing the world, I do that full time now. I just travel. I'm in Las Vegas, about to do that tomorrow. And I love doing it, and I can't wait to meet some of your listeners here.
Well, thanks so much, Dan, for sharing us your valuable insights on generative AI, as well as its critical importance to our digital economy. We wish you great success on your future endeavors.
Thank you so much, Edgar. It's been a pleasure getting to know you a little bit, talking about AI. I think I'm super optimistic. I think AI is going to change the world in lots of amazing, powerful ways. But also, you know, each of us has to take a look at what's going on and figure out how to constantly reinvent the way we tackle the work that we do on whatever team we're on. So thanks, Edgar, for having me. I really appreciate the time and looking forward to collaborating again in the future. Labs. We would like to express our sincere appreciation to Dan Chuverkov on sharing us his insightful views on generative AI and its significant importance to our digital economy. We would like to hear from you. Share us your thoughts regarding our topics and send us a message on the Anchor Voice message box. Your message could end up on our future podcast episode. Make sure you never miss any episodes of FinCircle by clicking the subscribe button or follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Pocket Cast, Audible, Overcast, TuneIn, CastBox, iHeartRadio, Anchor.fm, and affiliated podcast platform. You can also reach us on our website at fincircle.wordpress.com and our Facebook page at FinCircle Podcast. This concludes our podcast episode today. Thank you for listening on FinCircle. This is Ed Angelus. Let's catch up again soon.